In this second hour of Midday, Dr. Marty McCary of Johns Hopkins tells the story of a woman on a mission, Mama Maggie, a Coptic Christian who lives in Cairo and has for years been serving the poorest of the poor in the city's slums. Once a marketing executive and computer science professor, Mama Maggie was nominated for a Nobel Peace Prize. She's known as the Mother Teresa of Cairo, and Dr. McCary has written a book about her. He joins us this hour. We'll also meet wildlife photographer Pat Toth Smith and hear how she goes about snapping photos of black bears, owls, and other animals in remote places across the country. Plus, we get a report from Baltimore-based Catholic Relief Services about Nepal's recovery from two devastating earthquakes. That's on Midday Next after the news. And welcome back to Midday, everyone. Dan Roderick's here. It's our second hour. Thanks again for joining us. Wildlife photography. I don't know. It's that time of year. If you're out in the great outdoors and you have a camera, you probably think, geez, I wonder if I can get a picture of a black bear this summer. Pat Toth Smith has been doing this for a living for 20 years. She used to be a nurse. She's got a nurse who got interested in wildlife photography. She's going to be joining us later this hour to talk about her craft. She's out with a new book, a memoir, and photographs of black bears, owls, all kinds of animals that she's taken photographs of in remote places all across this country and in Canada. So we have that to look forward to in this hour. Also, an update, a report from Baltimore-based Catholic Relief Services about Nepal's recovery from two devastating earthquakes that in April and May that have claimed the lives of more than 8,500 people. In this segment of the show, we welcome back to Midday Dr. Marty McCary, Johns Hopkins physician, professor in surgery, and also in public health policy at the Bloomberg School of Public Health. Welcome back to the show. It's nice to see you again, Dr. McCary.
Great to be with you, Dan.
Now, the last time you were here, you wrote a book about health policy, about the cost of health care, and you write a lot about that and comment on in the media quite a bit about that. This is a very different book for you. This book is called Mama Maggie, The Untold Story of One Woman's Mission to Love the Forgotten Children of Egypt's Garbage Slums. It's got a beautiful photograph on the cover of this woman, Maggie Gobran, G-O-B-R-A-N. And what a fascinating story this is. Some people call her the Mother Teresa of Cairo. How did you come across this story?
Well, it turns out I'm related to Mama Maggie. I had heard about her, never really knew her growing up. My family is Egyptian. She is part of the Egyptian family over there. I was born in England, raised in Baltimore and Pennsylvania, now back working in Baltimore here the last 15 years. And I had heard about her incredible work there, heard there was a need for a doctor to come and do some medical work. I responded to that call, figured I'd meet this relative, help out, and use some of my medical skills. Well, I show up over there, Dan, and I realize I'm completely useless. I mean, they need things at the basic needs level that my medical training has not prepared me for at all. I'm so specialized. I mean, I'm taking care of complex pancreas cancers at Johns Hopkins Hospital.
Right.
I don't know the first thing about taking care of these kids that have basic needs. And I connected with her. And around that time, she was nominated for the Nobel Prize. I had been blown away by her work, heard from her that several authors from around the world wanted to tell her story, asked her for the rights to tell her story. She didn't know who they were, didn't trust them, was worried that they wouldn't be sensitive to Islam and the culture and all the progress they've made over there. And then she asked me to write her biography.
Now, how long has she been at this? Because her previous life, which we're going to talk about in a minute, is also, it's interesting that she made this transition. So, and she's not ordained or anything, right? She hasn't taken any vows.
No vows.
She's not a sister like as Mother Teresa was.
Unlike Mother Teresa, who came from poverty and took a vow to poverty, she came from wealth. Mama Maggie came from wealth and then took a vow for poverty.
She came from a well-to-do Coptic Christian family in Egypt.
Yeah, it's right? Amazing. Yeah, she comes from this incredible tradition of a faith group that dominated Egypt before the 700s and 800s. The Coptic language was the prominent language of Egypt. It was a mix of hieroglyphics and Greek, and it was a Christian nation. Egypt was a Christian nation. The word Egypt means land of the Copts, Egopt, Egypt. And they've come really through the worst of times in the last several decades, to the point where their populations dwindled down to 10% to 12% of the overall population.
Is that because they left Egypt, or because they've, I know there's been some violence against them, but and lots of discrimination.
Discrimination, but, pressure to convert, at different times in history, a higher tax for Christians, all sorts of different reasons.
So she's there, a Coptic Christian. She grows up in Cairo, and she becomes a marketing executive at one point. You can talk about that. That's interesting. But also a professor of computer science at a pretty elite school, the American University of Cairo. But tell us more about how did she, so she was a businesswoman.
She was a businesswoman, a socialite. She had the ideal sort of Western lifestyle in the metropolitan center of Egypt, Cairo. She drove a BMW. She worked with executives at big firms. She went out to the clubs and the country club and had this incredible life that everybody would say is what they would aspire to.
Was she married?
She was married to a very attractive woman and has two kids and was sort of the woman everyone wanted to be around.
Which came first, marketing executive or computer science professor?
I think marketing executive. Her business success led her to have that door open at the American University in Cairo, the most prestigious school over there for people wanting to study English.
Dr. Marty McCary of Johns Hopkins is our guest. The book we're talking about is Mama Maggie, The Untold Story of One Woman's Mission to Love the Forgotten Children of Egypt's Garbage Slums. So what got her to Egypt's garbage slums? She had an epiphany. She made a transition in her life.
You know, people say, why did you get involved in this charity and write this book? And the answer I say is to keep me grounded. We live in a world where everything is spinning around us, and to have something that keeps you grounded is so important. She was doing a day trip with her church into an area known as the garbage slums, where a lot of the refugees, if you will, a lot of the people from the rural areas that experience a lot of discrimination, a really rough economy, they move into the city, live in these slums because there's no place they can afford. And sure enough, the tens of thousands of kids are burrowed in the trash. And you think about the garbage slums, you hear about tens of thousands of people living there, and you think, oh, it's going to be basically impoverished adults. Well, it's all kids. And she met a kid who looked and was the same age as her daughter, and she was so moved by this, she went back on her own. The kid walked her back to her home, which was just an area burrowed out in the trash, and has introduced Mama Maggie to her six other brothers and sisters, all of whom lived this incredibly rough life. She was so moved by it, she kept coming back. She invited her friends to come with her. She kept going back. She took more days off of work and eventually decided to go all out, make this her full-time job, wear a white T-shirt for the rest of her life and a white dress or whatever simple outfit she has on. And she is seen as the mother of over 30,000 kids and has now 500 full-time employees and hundreds more volunteers. Some of the kids now have graduated from her curriculum and their vocational training program and have come back to work full-time with the other kids.
So talk about what services she set up and how she went about this. I mean, she was literally starting from scratch, right?
She's starting from scratch. Still to this day, they have no business card, barely have any office. Phone, no one ever picks up the phone. They're out there in the field working. And
schools?
They have 100 schools. They bought 3 factories. They put the kids through the factories for a few days or weeks at a time to learn how to sew, how to make shoes, leather work. They teach them vocational skills, and the kids go out there and get jobs, earn money for their families, and their kids then, their families rise up out of poverty. You know, Dan, when ISIS killed the 21 cops in Libya, seven of those were her children. They had gone through her program. Why were they in Libya? Because they had learned vocational skills, went out and got jobs, and they were sending money back to their families. That's the type of kid that went through her school. And if you watch any piece of that video, you see when they're about to be executed, they believe they are going to heaven. They have incredible faith. I mean, these are disciplined, incredible people who believe in what they believe in. And that you don't see that. You know, people ask me, why'd you write this? To keep me grounded. I mean, what an incredible demonstration. And to see the Mama Maggie organization now use the slaughter of those Christians, the cops in Libya by ISIS, as a lesson in their schools on forgiveness, that is teaching the message of breaking the cycle of revenge, and that's what the Middle East needs. Hmm.
Stephen's Children, that's the name of the organization that Mama Maggie established. Go back to the garbage slums for us for a moment. She didn't eradicate those. They still exist. Parents dig through the garbage looking for what they can, and do the children take part in that, or do the children just sort of wait for the parents? How does that look?
Yeah, everybody's doing it. Everybody's involved in it's the most efficient recycling operation in the world. The kids and the adults, mostly the kids, to be honest with you, rummage through the trash, and what you see, well, first thing, you walk in there, horrendous odor. After a couple hours, it's amazing you don't even notice it anymore. Horrendous odor. It almost knocks you down. You walk through these pathways in the trash, and you see a giant pile of blue plastic next to a giant pile of red plastic and yellow plastic. And you realize they've collected all this stuff, and they're going to recycle it. And this is how they sustain themselves.
And they're going to get paid for that, what they find.
They get paid. Sometimes pennies or dollars. But, yeah, they get paid, right. And that's how they live.
When you said you went there as a doctor and you really didn't know how to help her because the basics weren't in place, meaning to treat children for, what, sores on their feet, bad teeth, what, infections?
Exactly.
What did you see there?
Exactly. Poor hygiene-related disease, a lot of sores, a lot of infectious diseases, a lot of things for which the treatment might have been surgical and it was too much to extricate. You know, there was a lot of burn injuries. I mean, I spent a couple months on the burn service when I was a surgical resident. I never thought in the garbage slums in the impoverished district in the suburbs of Cairo would there be so many burn injuries.
Why are there so many? Because of there's fires? People are keeping warm with fires?
They're keeping warm, or they're using fire for cooking and other things. And, of course, it's the most inflammable conditions you can envision.
So she provides educational services and some vocational training. Does Stephen's Children try to provide medical or health services or not?
Yeah, they've got local doctors now. That's the amazing thing. There's no foreigners there. It's 100% Egyptians helping Egyptians. They're local doctors, and they take the bus because many of them can't afford to own a car because doctors outside of the United States sometimes don't make a lot of money like we do in the United States. And they go there and they set up these clinics and they teach hygiene. They teach classes on public health. They teach classes on population health to the women. They have women's health classes for the moms. Most of the fathers are actually absent from these homes.
Does Mama Maggie and those who work for her now, you said she had how many employees?
500.
500 employees. Over how many years? How long has it taken her to develop this?
25 years.
25 years. I assume that the children who take part or take advantage of these services they offer aren't all Coptic Christians.
They take care of Muslims and Christians alike. And there's a small Baha'i group in Egypt, but that's the message she's trying to send, is that people are beautiful regardless of what their belief or family tradition is, and we should treat all human beings with dignity.
Marty McCary, Dr. McCary, had you spent much time in Egypt before this?
I'd done some work in the bigger hospitals there as sort of a charity endeavor, but this was a game changer.
This took you to the garbage slums.
Took me to the garbage slums. I've been there five times since to write the book Mama Maggie, and still going back now just to help out.
When she made this transition from marketing executive, computer science professor at the American University in Cairo, she had come from a well-to-do family. It sounds like she was at least middle class or better in Cairo. How did her husband, family members, react to her decision to take on this mission?
incredibly supportive. You know, people think she's a nun because she kind of looks the part.
She kind of, yeah, because of, I guess, the white that she wears.
She wears this very simple white T-shirt and sometimes a scarf over her head. They see her as their mother. These 30,000 kids see her as their mother. That's why they call her Mama Maggie. That's the whole basis for the title of the book and for this organization. And you realize she'll tell you stories how these kids have never had anybody call them by their name. No one's ever asked them what their hopes or dreams are. They confide in her. She floats in the garbage districts, hanging out with different kids, listening to them confess or promise to do better or love their brother or support their mother who may be beating them. You know, there's all sorts of domestic violence and problems and abuse and sexual abuse, and all the problems that are in the rest of the world are there and magnified. But what you see is a resilient group of kids that are so happy when they are together and playing soccer and going to school, claiming Mama Maggie as their mother.
Do the kids get to go to school otherwise? Would they not be in school otherwise? They would just be hanging out with their parents. They wouldn't necessarily be in school.
Yeah, they wouldn't. These kids would not be in school. There
because
is school.
You have to pay to go to school, or
well, school goes up until a certain grade level, and then at that point you have to perform a certain proficiency in order to proceed. So education is a big problem over there, and many say that's one of the reasons why the Christian community has stayed so strong, is they value education, very similar to Jewish culture has valued education, and that's one of the reasons why they've been resilient.
I would like to meet Mama Maggie. I just wonder what she's like. It's a tough question maybe, but if you take a minute, can you describe her personality? What is it like to be in her presence, and how does she feel when she hears people compare her to Mother Teresa?
I feel that I'm in the presence of an angel when I talk to her. She's actually very soft-spoken. She doesn't have any real interest in talking about anything except for you and what you are excited about and the children. I asked her if she's ever met Mother Teresa because they were contemporaries, and she said, only in spirit. And you can see that sort of discipline in her. You know, she retreats every now and then to this cave where there's a monastery. It's connected to a monastery, one of the oldest monasteries in the world. It's in the Sinai Desert, and she goes there to pray for days at a time and feeds off of the garden there at the monastery. And she says that's where she gets recharged to go out and spend more time with the kids. And for a long time, this whole 25-year organization was sort of undercover, if you will. They were quiet because the old government regime there was a little threatening, and they just worried that somebody would come in and shut them down. And now with the revolutions, they feel proud to say, look, this is what we're doing, and these are the forgotten children of Egypt, and we love them.
What does she expect of you now? I mean, she gave you the rights to write the book, right?
Yeah.
She had first invited you there to help with the medical needs of the children.
Yeah.
What does she expect of you now?
I don't know, but I did tell her I promised that 100% of the book proceeds would go directly to help her organization and the kids. And not only did we get a very large book advance because of the success of the first book, Unaccountable, but I heard a report that it sold over 17,000 copies in the first month. So it's doing very well. And
that's great. It's only been out since May.
It's only been out since May. And people are excited. And people are reaching out or going to the website of Stephen's Children. And they're helping out and donating. And it's been just a privilege to be a part of this.
Yep. Last time Dr. Marty McCary was on our show was for his book, Unaccountable. And Ellen Vaughn, who is your co-author on this, she had a New York Times bestseller as well. So the two have teamed up. The book is called Mama Maggie, The Untold Story of One Woman's Mission to Love the Forgotten Children of Egypt's Garbage Slums. Is that mine? I meant to shut that off. I'm sorry about that. I usually tell my guests to shut off the phone. It's Marty McCary and Ellen Vaughn, co-authors of this, about the story of Maggie Gobran, also known as the Mother Teresa of Cairo, nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize in what year?
3 years ago.
Just 3 years ago. Does she get to be nominated again?
Yeah, I think there's plans to renominate.
The publisher is Thomas Nelson. Marty McCary is on the faculty at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health and the Medical School at Johns Hopkins and teaches surgery. It's nice to have you back on the show, and that's a great story. It's an untold story. It certainly is. I looked up some background on her and didn't see much. I saw one fairly brief New York Times story just earlier this year. Nothing before that.
You know, it's amazing. It's rare you see true, authentic love and charitable work. Here, when we see something like the Freddie Gray situation, we have avenues to do something. There, they've got no avenue to demonstrate, no politicians they can call on, no leaders they can relate to. They just have to put their head down, pray, keep going back to work.
Marty, nice to have you back on the show.
Great to see you,
Dan. Yeah, congratulations on the book. So all is you buy this book and the proceeds go to Stephen's
Children, 100%.
Stephen's Children, the programs of Mama Maggie.
Yes.
Excellent. Thank you very much for being here.
Great to be with
nice
you.
Nice to see you again. Stay with us, folks. We'll take a little break here on the Midday Show. When we come back, an update from Baltimore-based Catholic Relief Services about the recovery efforts in Nepal following those two deadly earthquakes. And then later on in the show, we'll hear from a wildlife photographer about how she does her thing all across this country and up into Canada. So please stay with us. Welcome back to Midday. This spring came and went, didn't it? Pretty quickly, but we were so focused on the local news here, all related to Freddie Gray. We didn't miss the Nepal story, but we certainly didn't pay as much attention as we might have had it not been for the local events. Nepal struck by two devastating earthquakes, resulting in the deaths now more than 8,500 people lost in those two earthquakes. The country has since struggled to distribute aid due to landslides, difficulty accessing all those far-flung villages in Nepal, and monsoon season approaching. Many are concerned about how the country is going to cope with all of this. Jennifer Poidatz is director of Baltimore-based Catholic Relief Services Humanitarian Response Department. And she's joining us now by phone, having just recently returned from Nepal. Jennifer, thank you for making time for us today.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. I guess we need to catch up on this story. Could you talk a little bit about, first of all, sort of the landscape of where this occurred in Nepal and where Catholic Relief Services deployed there?
Sure. The earthquakes happened, both of them, to the north and northwest of Kathmandu, the capital city.
Mm-hmm.
And Catholic Relief Services, we were on the ground immediately working with our local partner, Caritas Nepal, who already had offices and infrastructure in the earthquake affected area. So we were able to move teams in quickly, people coming from outside other countries, but especially our country team in India, to start the immediate relief, which actually that phase has been completed. We've been able to provide immediate assistance in terms of shelter supplies, supplies for the safekeeping of water, and other immediate needs to over 13,000 households or around 70,000 people.
I use the term far-flung villages, so it's quite a large area that you had to cover in order to get aid to people.
Yes, it is, especially. So we're working in one district, which is one of the highly affected districts called Gorkha. In that district itself, there's varying elevations. Now reaching the higher elevation areas, we're actually using helicopter transport to get into those areas to distribute iron sheeting for roofing that will be used throughout the monsoon season, as well as other materials for the temporary shelter.
So there's a fairly predictable monsoon season. Are we approaching it midsummer?
We have. It actually has started already. Mm. So the rains are coming daily, very heavy. So we're really rushing to finish up this phase, which we're calling the transitional phase, which will give people the things they need to make it through the monsoon season, and then we'll start reconstruction of housing. There were over a half a million houses either destroyed or partially destroyed, so that will be our focus once the rains stop.
You know, this is interesting just to note how Catholic Relief Services operates in situations like this. What was the organization you mentioned at the outset that already had some relief infrastructure in place?
It's called Caritas Nepal. Caritas is, CRS is actually Caritas U.S.
Mm-hmm.
So we're all members. There's 164 Caritas agencies worldwide. We're all members of Caritas International.
So when you respond, you already have in place people in countries all around the world in order to get relief aid to people. There's already something in place.
Exactly. It's either our own staff of Catholic Relief Services or a partner staff like Caritas, who has people and infrastructure and people who have been trained in emergency response and recovery.
Jennifer, what was the interval of the earthquakes? There was one in April and then another in May, right?
Yes, there was one in early May.
So the interval was what, just a couple of weeks?
It was 3 weeks, if I'm not mistaken, yeah.
And were those areas very distant from each other, or were they nearby?
They were not so close to each other, but the actual area affected was very similar. So in terms of, we were actually, during the second earthquake, we were doing distributions, emergency distributions, so plastic sheeting and rope and sleeping mats, et cetera, in one of the affected areas. And when the second earthquake hit, we actually, in the distribution area itself, we saw, our staff saw a school collapse. Fortunately, there was nobody in it, but other buildings being affected. So there were areas that were affected twice in just a short period of time, which is, you can imagine, was very traumatizing to the population.
Yes, I can imagine that. And also, I wonder about relief workers. When you decide to deploy relief workers into areas that may still be experiencing tremors and landslides.
Yeah, we do have to be extremely careful in terms of, again, what buildings we use to house our staff. I mean, most in the early stages, we do a lot of sleeping outside and just being careful and doing security checks of where we're staying and where we're going. That has to be done on a regular basis, given the evolving situation. But it is challenging.
Well, Jennifer, you're back here in the States now.
Yes, I am, just for a few days.
So what's going on the ground as we speak then? The sheet metal has gone into place, has been distributed and put in place. What else is CRS doing there?
Yeah, so we are continuing with the distribution of the iron sheets for temporary housing. In addition to that, we are actually giving out cash grants. So the cash grants can be used by households to buy shelter materials themselves. So those are in areas where we know the market has recovered and the items are available in the market. So as opposed to giving out things in kind, so giving out the sheeting itself, we can give cash and people can go to the market and buy the materials to reconstruct their houses. In addition to that, we've already started planning for the recovery phase, so that's the reconstruction of permanent housing. So we're building demonstration houses in communities so we can get feedback from the population in terms of, is it appropriate, what are the materials needed, looking at how the reconstruction is done so people are actually building back safer and using construction methods that will help resist further future disasters.
Jennifer, thanks for spending some time with us today. Thank you for your work, too.
Thank you very much for having me.
Yep. Jennifer Poidatz is director of CRS, that's Catholic Relief Services Humanitarian Response Department. Of course, CRS is based, their headquarters here is in Baltimore. She spoke to us about their efforts in Nepal. We'll take a break here on Midday. When we come back, wildlife photographer Pat Toth-Smith. We'll hear how she goes about snapping photos of black bears and owls and her encounters with moose
all across this country, up in the Northwest, in Alaska, and in Canada. Pat will be joining us in just a few minutes. If you're interested in that, I hope you will be. How she goes about taking pictures of animals in the wild. I'm looking forward to this conversation. We'll be back in about 2 minutes. And this is the Midday Show. Dan Roderick's here. Now we turn to the craft of wildlife photography. Pat Toth-Smith is a wildlife photographer, an award-winning one, who's traveled throughout the U.S. and Canada and some other countries, primarily taking photographs at national, state, and regional parks. And we're speaking to Pat today because she's put together a collection of photographs and a memoir called Wild Among Us, detailing her adventures as a wildlife photographer. And it's nice to get you on the show, Pat Toth-Smith. Thanks for joining us here on Midday.
Well, thanks for having me. I appreciate being on.
Well, I understand you didn't start off in life as a wildlife photographer. I guess no one really does. but you were on a different career path. Let's see. I have you as growing up in New Jersey. Is that right?
Yeah, I grew up in New Jersey. And actually, what you're talking about is I became a nurse while I was in New Jersey.
Yeah. Yeah.
Actually, I started out as a nurse, and it was actually a great profession. The only thing is the last job that I had in nursing was hospice, and I got pretty emotionally drained, and I was really ready for a change, and I was looking for something a little more creative, and photography had always been a great hobby of mine, and I ended up deciding to make a career change to photography.
What was your first real camera?
Oh, my gosh.
Minolta single lens reflex. What was it? A Minolta SR. What was that? Never mind. I'm kidding. What was your first camera, Pat?
Well, I'm going to disappoint all the Nikon people out there because I had a Canon A1.
A Canon A1. What's wrong with that?
Well, you know, Nikon and Canon are always competitive.
I know.
Back then, they were very competitive. But yeah, actually, I still have my little A1.
Well, how old were you when you got your Canon?
I was probably, about 28, 29. Oh. I started a little late.
Okay. Well, you were a nurse first, but when you were growing up, it sounds like your dad, both your dad and your mom were outdoors people.
Well, it was actually my dad. My mom was not so much, but my dad, he was a hunter, and he actually would drive us around looking for deer. And I actually, I enjoyed that, ironically, and we used to joke about it as kids. But, I actually do that now quite a bit, and I still enjoy it. And my mom was into photography. She would take tons and tons of pictures of me with her little, she had this, movie camera back in the day with the big actual flashlight and all of that. So it was kind of neat.
When your dad took you around, he was spotting deer for hunting season. Is that right?
Well, I think hunters in some way have a love for these animals too, ironically, but he used to love looking at them too. So I don't know, it's kind of a mixed bag there, but I just love to shoot them with my camera only.
Well, let me go over something with you, because almost everybody has taken a